This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of To Tame a Highland Warrior by Karen Marie Monning, performed by Phil Giganti. A Celtic legend. Legend tells that the power of the berserker, preternatural strength, prowess, virility, and cunning, can be bought for the going rate of a man's soul. In the heather hills of the Highlands, the Viking god Odin lurks in shadowy places, listening for the bitter howl of a man brutalized beyond mortal endurance to invoke his aid. Legend holds that if the mortal is worthy, the primal breath of the gods blows into the man's heart, making him an undefeatable warrior. Women whisper that the berserker is an incomparable lover. Legend holds there is a single true mate for him, like the wolf. He loves but once and for all time. High in the mountains of Scotland, the Circle Elders say that the berserker, once summoned, can never be dismissed. And if the man does not learn to accept the primitive instincts of the beast within, he will die. Legend tells of such a man. Prologue. Death itself is better than a life of shame. Beowulf. Maldaban Castle, the Highlands of Scotland, 1499. The screaming had to stop. He couldn't endure it another minute, yet he knew he was helpless to save them. His family, his clan, his best friend Aaron, with whom he'd ridden the heather fields only yesterday, and his mother. Oh, but his mother was another story. Her murder had presaged this barbaric. He turned away, cursing himself for a coward. If he couldn't save them, and he couldn't die with them, at least he owed them the honor of scribing the events into his memory, to avenge their deaths, one at a time, if necessary. Vengeance doesn't bring back the dead. How many times had his father said that? Once, Gavril had believed in him, but that had been before he'd discovered his mighty, wise, and wonderful Da crouched over his mother's body this morning, his shirt bloodstained, a dripping dagger in his fist. Gavril MacIliac, only son of the Laird of Maldaban, stood motionless upon Votan's cleft, gazing down the sheer cliff at the village of Tuluth, which filled the valley hundreds of feet below. He wondered how this day had turned so bitter. Yesterday had been a fine day, filled with the simple pleasures of a lad who would one day govern these lush highlands. Then this cruel morning had broken, and with it his heart. After discovering his Da crouched above the savaged body of Jolin MacIliac, Gavril had fled for the sanctuary of the dense highland forest, where he'd passed most of the day swinging wildly between rage and grief. Eventually, both had receded, leaving him oddly detached. At dusk, he'd retraced his path to Castle Maldaban to confront his sire with accusations of murder in a final attempt to make sense of what he'd witnessed, if there was sense to be made. But now, standing on the cliff high above Tuluth, the 14-year-old son of Ronan MacIliac realized his nightmare had only begun. Castle Maldaban was under siege. The village was engulfed in flames, and people were darting frantically between pillars of flames and piles of the dead. Gavril watched helplessly as a small boy sped past a hut directly into the blade of a waiting MacCain. He recoiled. They were only children, but children could grow up to seek vengeance, and the fanatic MacCain never left seeds of hatred to take root and bear poisonous fruit. By the light of the fire engulfing the huts, he could see that the MacCain severely outnumbered his people. The distinctive green and gray plaids of the hated enemy were a dozen to each MacIliac. "It's almost as though they knew we'd be vulnerable," Gavril thought. More than half the MacIliac were away in the north attending a wedding. Gavril despised being 14, although he was tall and broad for his age, with shoulders that hinted at exceptional strength to come. He knew he was no match for the burly MacCain. They were warriors with powerfully developed, mature bodies, driven by obsessive hatred. They trained ceaselessly, existing solely to pillage and kill. Gavril would be no more significant than a tenacious pup yapping at a bear. He could plunge into the battle below, but he would die as inconsequentially as the boy had moments before. If he had to die tonight, he swore he would make it mean something.
Berserker,
the wind seemed to whisper. Gavril cocked his head, listening. Not only was his world being destroyed, now he was hearing voices. Were his wits to fail him before this terrible day ended? He knew the legend of the berserkers was simply that, a legend.
Beseech the gods.
The rustling branches of the pines hissed.
Right,
Gavril muttered, as he'd been doing ever since he'd first heard the fearsome tale at the age of 9. There was no such thing as a berserker. It was a foolish tale, told to frighten mischievous children into good behavior.
Berserker.
This time the sound was clearer, too loud to be his imagination. Gavril spun about and searched the massive rocks behind him. Votan's cleft was a tumble of boulders and odd standing stones that cast unnatural shadows beneath the full moon. It was rumored to be a sacred place, where chieftains of yore had met to plan wars and determine fates. It was a place that could almost make a stripling lad believe in the demonic. He listened intently, but the wind carried only the screams of his people. It was too bad the pagan tales weren't true. Legend claimed berserkers could move with such speed that they seemed invisible to the human eye until the moment they attacked. They possessed unnatural senses, the olfactory acuity of a wolf, the auditory sensitivity of a bat, the strength of 20 men, the penetrating eyesight of an eagle. The berserkers had once been the most fearless and feared warriors ever to walk Scotland nearly 700 years ago. They had been Odin's elite Viking army. Legend claimed they could assume the shape of a wolf or a bear as easily as the shape of a man, and they were marked by a common feature, unholy blue eyes that glowed like banked coals.
Berserker,
the wind sighed.
There is no such thing as a berserker,
Gavril grimly informed the knight. He was no longer the foolish boy who'd been infatuated with the prospect of unbeatable strength, no longer the youth who'd once been willing to offer his immortal soul for absolute power and control. Besides, his own eyes were deep brown, and always had been. Never had history recorded a brown-eyed berserker.
Call me.
Gavril flinched. This last figment of his traumatized mind had been a command, undeniable, irresistible. The hair on the back of his neck stood up on end and his skin prickled. Not once in all his years of playing at summoning a berserker had he ever felt so peculiar. His blood pounded through his veins, and he felt as if he teetered on the brink of an abyss that both lured and repulsed him. Screams filled the valley. Child after child fell while he stood high above the battle, helpless to alter the course of events. He would do anything to save them. Barter, trade, steal, murder, anything. Tears streamed down his face as a tiny lass with blonde ringlets wailed her last breath. There would be no mother's arms for her, no bonny suitor, no wedding, no babes, not a breath more of precious life. Blood stained the front of her frock, and he stared at it, mesmerized. His universe narrowed to a tunnel of vision in which the blood blossoming on her chest became a vast crimson whirlpool, sucking him down and down. Something inside him snapped. He threw back his head and howled, the words ricocheting off the rocks of Votan's cleft.
Hear me, Odin! I summon the berserker! I, Gavril Roderick Icarus MacIliac, offer my life, nay, my soul, for vengeance! I command the berserker!
The moderate breeze turned suddenly violent, lashing leaves and dirt into the air. Gavril flung his arms up to shield his face from the needle-sharp sting of flying debris. Branches, No match for the fierce gale snapped free and battered his body like clumsy spears hurled from the trees. Black clouds scuttled across the night sky, momentarily obscuring the moon. The unnatural wind keened through the channels of rock on Votan's cleft, briefly muffling the screams from the valley below. Suddenly, the night exploded in a flash of dazzling blue, and Gavril felt his body change. He snarled, baring his teeth as he felt something irrevocable mutate deep within him. He could smell dozens of scents from the battle below, the rusty metallic odor of blood and steel and hate. He could hear whispers from the McCain camp on the far horizon. He saw for the first time that the warriors appeared to be moving in slow motion. How had he failed to notice it before? It would be absurdly easy to slip in and destroy them all while they were moving as if slogging through wet sand. So easy to destroy. So easy. Gavril sucked in rapid breaths of air, pumping his chest full before charging into the valley below. As he plunged into the slaughter, the sound of laughter echoed off the stone basin that cupped the valley. He realized it was coming from his own lips only when the McCain began to fall beneath his sword. Hours later, Gavril stumbled through the burning remains of Tuluth. The McCain were gone, either dead or driven off. The surviving villagers were tending the wounded and walking in wide, cautious circles around the young son of the MacIliac.
"Near to 70 ye killed, lad,"
an old man with bright eyes whispered when Gavril passed.
"Not even your da in his prime could do such a thing. Ye be far more berserk."
Gavril glanced at him, startled. Before he could ask what he meant by that comment, the old man melted into the billowing smoke.
"You took down 3 in one swing of your sword, lad,"
another man called. A child flung his arms around Gavril's knees.
"You saved my life, you did,"
the lad cried.
"The old McCain would have had me for his supper. Thank you. Me ma's thinking you too."
Gavril smiled at the boy, then turned to the mother, who crossed herself and didn't look remotely appreciative. His smile faded.
"I'm not a monster."
"I know what you are, lad."
Her gaze never left his. To Gavril's ears, her words were harsh and condemning.
"I know exactly what you are, and don't be thinking otherwise. Get on with you now. Your dad's in trouble."
She pointed a quivering finger past the last row of smoldering huts. Gavril narrowed his eyes against the smoke and stumbled forward. He'd never felt so drained in all his life. Moving awkwardly, he rounded one of the few huts still standing and jerked to a halt. His da was crumpled on the ground, covered with blood, his sword abandoned at his side in the dirt. Grief and anger vied for supremacy in Gavril's heart, leaving him strangely hollow. As he stared down at his father, the image of his mother's body surged to the forefront of his mind, and the last of his youthful illusions shattered. Tonight had birthed both an extraordinary warrior and a flesh-and-blood man with inadequate defenses.
"Why, da? Why?"
His voice broke harshly on the words. He would never see his mother smile again, never hear her sing, never attend her burial, for he would be leaving Maldaban once his da replied, lest he turn his residual rage upon his own father. And then what would he be? No better than his da. Ronan MacIliac groaned. Slowly, he opened his eyes in a blood-crusted squint and gazed up at his son. A ribbon of scarlet trickled from his lips as he struggled to speak.
"Where? Born?"
He broke off, consumed by a deep, racking cough. Gavril grabbed his father by handfuls of his shirt, and heedless of Ronan's pained grimace, shook him roughly. He would have his answer before he left. He would discover what madness had driven his da to kill his mother, or he would be tortured all his life by unanswered questions.
"What da? Say it! Tell me why!"
Ronan's bleary gaze sought Gavril's. His chest rose and fell as he drew swift, shallow gasps of smoky air. With a strange undertone of sympathy, he said,
"Son, we canna help it. The MacIliac men always were born this way."
Gavril stared at his father in horror.
You would say that to me? You think you can convince me that I'm mad like you? I'm not like you. I'll not believe you. You lie. You lie.
He lunged to his feet, backing hastily away. Ronan McKillock forced himself up on his elbows and jerked his head at the evidence of Gavril's savagery, the remains of McCain warriors who had been literally ripped to pieces.
You did that, son.
I am not a ruthless killer.
Gavril scanned the mutilated bodies, not quite convinced of his own words.
It's part of being McKillock. You cannot help it, son.
Don't call me son. I will never be your son again. And I am not part of your sickness. I'm not like you. I will never be like you.
Ronan sank back to the ground, muttering incoherently. Gavril deliberately closed his ears to the sound. He would not listen to his Da's lies a moment longer. He turned his back on him and surveyed what was left of Tuluth. The surviving villagers huddled in small groups, standing in absolute silence, watching him, averting his face from what he would always remember as their reproving regard. His glance slid up the dark stone of Maldaban Castle. Carved into the side of the mountain, it towered above the village. Once, he had wished for nothing more than to grow up and help govern Maldaban at his Da's side, eventually taking over as chieftain. He'd wished to always hear the lovely lilt of his mother's laughter filling the spacious halls, to hear his Da's answering rumble as they joked and talked. He'd dreamed of wisely settling his people's concerns, of marrying one day, and having sons of his own. Aye, once he had believed all those things would come to pass. But in less time than it had taken the moon to bridge the sky above Tuluth, all his dreams, and the very last part of him that had been human, were destroyed. It took Gavril the better part of a day to drag his battered body back up into the sanctuary of the dense highland forests. He could never go home. His mother was dead, the castle ransacked, and the villagers had regarded him with fear. His Da's words haunted him. We're born this way. Killers, capable of murdering even those they claimed to love. It was a sickness of the mind, Gavril thought, which his father said he, too, carried in his blood. Thirstier than he'd ever been, he half-crawled to the loch nestled in a small valley beyond Votan's cleft. He collapsed for a time on the springy tundra, and when he wasn't quite so dizzy and weak, he struggled forward to drink, dragging himself on his elbows. As he cupped his hands and bent over the sparkling clear pool, he froze, mesmerized by his reflection rippling in the water. Ice-blue eyes stared back at him. Chapter 1. Dalkeith upon the Sea, the Highlands of Scotland, 1515. Grimm paused at the open doors of the study and gazed into the night. The reflection of stars dappled the restless ocean like tiny pinpoints of light cresting the waves. Usually he found the sound of the sea crashing against the rocks soothing, but lately it seemed to incite in him a questing restlessness. As he resumed pacing, he sifted through possible reasons for his unrest and came up empty-handed. It had been by choice that he remained at Dalkeith as captain of the Douglas Guard when, 2 years ago, he and his best friend, Hawk Douglas, left Edinburgh in King James' service. Grimm adored Hawk's wife, Adrienne, when she wasn't trying to marry him off, and he doted upon their young son, Carthian. He had been, if not exactly happy, content, at least until recently. So what ailed him?
You're wearing holes in my favorite rug with your pacing, Grimm, and the painter will never be able to finish this portrait if you won't sit down,
Adrienne teased, jarring him from his melancholy reverie. Grimm expelled a breath and ran a hand through his thick hair. Absent-mindedly, he fiddled with a section at his temple, twisting the strands into a plait as he continued to contemplate the sea.
You aren't looking for a wishing star out there, are you, Grimm?
Hawk Douglas's black eyes danced with mirth.
Hardly. And any time your mischievous wife would care to tell me what curse she laid upon me with her careless wishing, I'd be happy to hear it.
Some time ago, Adrian Douglas had wished upon a falling star, and she steadfastly refused to tell either of them what she'd wished until she was absolutely certain it had been heard and granted. The only thing she would admit was that her wish had been made on Grimm's behalf, which unnerved him considerably. Although he didn't consider himself a superstitious man, he'd seen enough odd occurrences in the world to know that merely because something seemed improbable certainly didn't render it impossible.
"As would I, Grimm," Hawks said dryly. "But she won't tell me either."
Adrian laughed.
"Go on with the two of you. Don't tell me two such fearless warriors suffer a moment's concern over a woman's idle wish upon a star."
"I consider nothing you do idle, Adrian,"
Hawk replied with a wry grin.
"The universe does not behave in a normal fashion where you're concerned."
Grimm smiled faintly. It certainly didn't. Adrian had been tossed back in time from the 20th century, the victim of a wicked plot to destroy the Hawk, concocted by a vindictive fairy. Impossible things happened around Adrian, which is why he wanted to know what bloody wish she'd made. He'd like to be prepared when all hell broke loose.
"Do sit down, Grimm," Adrian urged. "I want this portrait finished by Christmas at the latest, and it takes Albert months to paint from his sketches."
"Only because my work is sheer perfection," the painter said, miffed.
Grimm turned his back on the knight and reclaimed his seat by Hawk in front of the fire.
"I still do not get the point of this," Grimm muttered. "Portraits are for lasses and children."
Adrian snorted.
"I commission a painter to immortalize two of the most magnificent men I've ever laid eyes upon."
She flashed them a dazzling smile, and Grimm rolled his eyes, knowing he would do whatever the lovely Adrian wished when she smiled like that.
"And all they can do is grumble. I'll have you know, one day you'll thank me for doing this."
Grimm and Hawk exchanged amused glances, then resumed the pose she insisted displayed their muscular physiques and dark good looks to their finest advantage.
"Be certain you color Grimm's eyes as brilliantly blue as they are," she instructed Albert.
"As if I don't know how to paint," he muttered. "I am the artist here, unless, of course, you'd like to try your hand at it."
"I thought you liked my eyes."
Hawk narrowed his black eyes at Adrian.
"I do. I married you, didn't I?"
Adrian teased, smiling.
"Can I help it if the staff at Dalkeith, to the youngest maid of a tender 12 years, swoons over your best friend's eyes? When I hold my sapphires up to the sunlight, they look exactly the same. They shimmer with iridescent blue fire."
"What are mine, puny black walnuts?"
Adrian laughed.
"Silly man. That's how I described your heart when I first met you. And stop fidgeting, Grimm," she chided. "Or is there some reason you want those braids at your temples in this portrait?"
Grimm froze, then slowly touched his hair in disbelief. Hawk stared at him.
"What's on your mind, Grimm?"
he asked, fascinated. Grimm swallowed. He hadn't even realized he'd plaited the war braids into his hair. A man wore war braids only during the blackest hours of his life, when he was mourning his lost mate or preparing for battle. So far, he'd worn them twice. What had he been thinking? Grimm stared blankly at the floor, confused, unable to vocalize his thoughts. Lately he'd been obsessed with ghosts of the past, memories he'd tossed savagely into a shallow grave years ago and buried beneath a thin sod of denials. But in his dreams, the shadow corpses walked again, trailing behind them a residue of unease that clung to him throughout the day. Grimm was still struggling to answer when a guard burst through the doors to the study.
"My lord, my lady."
The guard nodded deferentially to Hawk and Adrian as he hastily entered the room. He approached Grimm, a somber expression on his face.
"This just came for you, Captain."
He thrust an official-looking piece of parchment into Grimm's hands.
"The messenger insisted 'twas urgent, and to be delivered into your hands only."
Grimm turned the message slowly in his hand. The elegant crest of Gibraltar St. Clair was pressed into the red wax. Suppressed memories broke over him.
Jillian.
She was a promise of beauty and joy he could never possess, a memory he'd consigned to that same uncooperative, shallow grave that now seemed determined to regurgitate its dead.
Well, open it, Grim,
Adrian urged. Slowly, as if he held a wounded animal that might turn on him with sharp teeth, Grim broke the seal and opened the missive. Stiffly, he read the terse, three-word command. His hand fisted reflexively, crumpling the thick vellum. Rising, he turned to the guard.
Prepare my horse. I leave in 1 hour.
The guard nodded and left the study.
Well? Hawk demanded. What does it say?
Nothing you need address, Hawk. Do not worry. It doesn't concern you.
Anything that concerns my best friend concerns me, Hawk said. So give over. What's wrong?
I said nothing. Leave it, man.
Grim's voice held a note of warning that would have restrained a lesser man's hand. But the Hawk had never been and would never be a lesser man, and he moved so unexpectedly that Grim didn't react quickly enough when he whisked the parchment from his hand. Grinning mischievously, Hawk backed away and uncrumpled the parchment. His grin broadened, and he winked at Adrian.
Come for Jillian, it says. A woman, is it? The plot thickens. I thought you'd sworn off women, my fickle friend. So, who's Jillian?
A woman! Adrian exclaimed delightedly. A young, marriageable woman?
Stop it, you two. It's not like that.
Then why were you trying to keep it a secret, Grim? Hawk pressed.
Because there are things you do not know about me, and it would take far too long to explain. Lacking the leisure to tell you the full story, I'll send you a message in a few months.
He evaded coolly.
You're not getting out of this so easily, Grim Roderick.
Hawk rubbed the shadow beard on his stubborn jaw thoughtfully.
Who is Jillian? And how do you know Gibraltar St. Clair? I thought you came to court directly from England. I thought you knew no one in all of Scotland but for those you met at court.
I didn't exactly tell you the whole story, Hawk. And I don't have time for it now, but I'll tell you as soon as I get settled.
You'll tell me now, or I'm coming with you, Hawk threatened. Which means Adrian and Carthian are coming as well, so you can either tell me or prepare for company, and you never know what might happen if Adrian comes along.
Grim scowled. You really can be a pain, Hawk.
Relentless. Formidable, Adrian agreed sweetly. You may as well give in, Grim. My husband never takes no for an answer. Believe me, I know this.
Come on, Grim. If you can't trust me, who can you trust? He coaxed. Where are you going?
It's not a question of trust, Hawk.
Hawk merely waited with an expectant look on his face, and Grim knew he had no intention of relenting. Hawk would push and poke and ultimately do exactly as he threatened, come along, unless Grim gave him a sufficient answer. Perhaps it was time he admitted the truth, although the odds were that once he did, he wouldn't be welcomed back at Dalkeith.
I'm going home, sort of,
Grim finally conceded.
Caithness is your home.
Tuluth,
Grim muttered.
What?
Tuluth,
Grim said flatly.
I was born in Tuluth.
You said you were born in Edinburgh.
A light.
Why? You told me your entire family was dead. Was that a lie, too?
No, they are. I didn't lie about that. Well, mostly I didn't lie,
he corrected hastily.
My da is still alive, but I haven't spoken to him in more than 15 years.
A muscle twitched in Hawk's jaw.
Sit down, Grim. You're not going anywhere until you tell me all of it, and I suspect it's a tale that's long overdue.
I don't have time, Hawk. If St. Clair said it was urgent, I was needed at Caithness weeks ago.
What relevance has Caithness to any of this, or to you? Sit. Talk. Now.
Sensing no possibility of reprieve, Grim paced as he began his story. He told them how, at the age of 14, he'd left Tuluth the night of the massacre and wandered the forests of the Highlands for 2 years, wearing his war braids and hating mankind, hating his father, hating himself. He skipped the brutal parts, his mother's murder, the starvation he'd endured, the repeated attempts on his life. He told them that when he was 16, he'd found shelter with Gibraltar St. Clair, that he'd changed his name to Grimm to protect himself and those for whom he cared. He told them how the McCain had found him again at Caithness and attacked his foster family. And finally, in the tone of a dreaded confession, he told them what his real name had been.
"What did you just say?"
Hawk asked blankly. Grimm drew a deep breath into his lungs and expelled it angrily.
"I said Gavril. My real name is Gavril."
There was only one Gavril in all of Scotland. No other man would willingly own up to that name and that curse. He braced himself for the Hawk's explosion. He didn't have to wait for long.
"McIlliac?"
Hawk's eyes narrowed disbelievingly.
"McIlliac,"
Grimm confirmed.
"And Grimm?"
"Grimm stands for Gavriel Roderick Icarus McIlliac."
Grimm's Highland brogue rolled so thickly around the name, it was a nearly unintelligible burr of R's and L's and staccato sharp K's.
"Take the first letter of each name, and there you have it. G-R-I-M.
Gavril McIlliac was a berserker,"
Hawk roared.
"I told you, you didn't know so much about me,"
Grimm said darkly. Crossing the study in three swift strides, Hawk bristled to a stop inches from Grimm's face and studied him, as if he might uncover some telltale trace of a beast that should have betrayed Grimm's secret years ago.
"How could I not have known?" Hawk muttered. "For years I've been wondering about some of your peculiar talents. By the bloody saints, I should have guessed, if only from your eyes."
"Lots of people have blue eyes, Hawk,"
Grimm said dryly.
"Not like yours, Grimm,"
Adrian remarked.
"That explains it all,"
Hawk said slowly.
"You're not human."
Grimm flinched. Adrian leveled a dark look at her husband and linked her arm through Grimm's.
"Of course he's human, Hawk. He's just human, plus some."
"A berserker,"
Hawk shook his head.
"A fardling berserker. You know, they say William Wallace was a berserker."
"And what a lovely life he had, eh?"
Grimm said bitterly. Grimm rode out shortly thereafter, answering no more questions and leaving the Hawk immensely dissatisfied. He left quickly, because the memories were returning of their own accord and with fury. Grimm knew he had to be alone when full recollection finally reclaimed him. He didn't willingly think about Tuluth anymore. Hell, he didn't willingly think anymore, not if he could help it. Tuluth. In his memory, a smoky valley, clouds of black so thick his eyes had stung from the acrid stench of burning homes and burning flesh. Children screaming.
Oh, Christ!
Grimm swallowed hard as he spurred Occam into a gallop across the ridge. He was impervious to the beauty of the Highland night, lost in another time, surrounded only by the color of blood and the blackness of soul-disfiguring desolation, with one shimmering spot of gold. Chilean.
"Is he an animal, da? May I keep him, please? He's an ever-so-glorious beastie."
And in his mind, he was 16 years old again, looking down at the wee golden lass. Memory swept over him, dripping shame thicker than clotted honey off a comb. She'd found him in the woods, scavenging like a beast.
"He'd be fiercer than my Savannah Tea Garden, da."
Savannah Tea Garden being her puppy, all 140 pounds of Irish wolfhound puppy.
"He'd protect me well, da. I knew he would."
The instant she'd said the words, he'd taken a silent vow to do just that, never dreaming it might one day entail protecting her from himself. Grimm rubbed his clean-shaven jaw and tossed his head in the wind. For a brief moment he felt the matted hair again, the dirt and sweat and the war braids, the fierce eyes brimming with hatred. And the pure, sweet child had trusted him on sight. Ugh, but he dissuaded her quickly. Chapter 2. Gibraltar and Elizabeth St. Clair had been riding toward their son's home in the Highlands for over a week before Gibraltar finally confessed his plan. He wouldn't have told her at all, but he couldn't stand to see his wife upset.
"Did you hear that?"
Elizabeth said accusingly to her husband as she rounded her mare and cantered back to his side.
"Did you?"
"Hear what? I couldn't hear a thing." "You were too far away," he teased.
"That's it, Gibraltar. I've had it."
Gibraltar raised an inquiring brow.
"What's it, love?"
Flushed with outrage, his wife was even more alluring than she was when calm. He wasn't above gently provoking her to enjoy the show. Elizabeth tossed her head briskly.
"I am sick of hearing men talk about our flawless, saintly, unwed, as in nearly a spinster, daughter, Gibraltar."
"You've been eavesdropping again, haven't you, Elizabeth?" he asked mildly.
"Eavesdropping, schmeavesdropping. If my daughter is being discussed, even if only by the guards,"
she gestured in their direction irritably,
"I have every right to listen. Our fearsome protectors, who I might point out are perfectly healthy, full-grown men, have been trading tributes to her virtues. By virtues, they don't mean her breasts or any of her lovely curves, but her sweet temper, her patience, her calling to the cloister, for goodness sakes. Did she breathe a word to you about this sudden inclination to devote herself to the nunnery?"
Without waiting for an answer, Elizabeth reined in her mount and glared at him.
"They go on and on about how flawless she is, and not one of them says a word about topping her."
Gibraltar laughed as he drew his stallion to a halt beside her mare.
"How dare you think this is funny?"
Gibraltar shook his head, his eyes sparkling. Only Elizabeth would take offense that men didn't talk about seducing their only daughter.
"Gibraltar, I must ask you to be serious for a moment. Chilian is 21 years old, and not one man has seriously tried to court her. I vow she's the most exquisite lass in all of Scotland, and men walk quietly worshipful circles around her. Do something, Gibraltar! I'm getting worried!"
His smile faded. Elizabeth was right. It was no longer a laughing matter. Gibraltar had reached that conclusion himself. It wasn't fair to let Elizabeth continue worrying when he'd taken action that would soon put both their fears to rest.
"I've already taken care of it, Elizabeth."
"What do you mean? What have you done this time?"
Gibraltar studied her intently. At the moment, he wasn't completely certain which would upset Elizabeth more, continued worry over their daughter's unwed state, or the details of what he'd done without consulting her. A uniquely masculine moment of reflection convinced him she would be dazzled by his ingenuity.
"I've arranged for 3 men to attend Caithness in our absence, Elizabeth. By the time we return, either Gillian will have chosen one of them, or one of them will have chosen her. They are not the kind of men who give up in the face of a wee bit of resistance, nor are they the kind of men to fall for her nunnery stories."
Elizabeth's horrified expression deflated his smug pose.
"One of them will choose her? Are you saying that one of these men you've selected might compromise her if she doesn't choose?"
"Seduce, Elizabeth, not compromise,"
Gibraltar protested.
"They wouldn't ruin her. They're all honorable, respectable lairds."
His voice deepened persuasively.
"I selected these 3 based in part on the fact that they are also all very,
He searched for a word innocuous enough that it wouldn't alarm his wife, because the men he'd chosen could be patently alarming.
"Masculine men."
His perfunctory nod was intended to soothe her concerns. It failed.
"Exactly what Gillian needs," he assured her.
"Masculine. You mean randy, inveterate blackguards, probably domineering and ruthless to boot. Don't prevaricate with me, Gibraltar."
Gibraltar sighed gustily, any hope of subtle persuasion debunked.
Do you have a better idea, Elizabeth? Frankly, I think the problem is that Gillian has never met a man who wasn't intimidated by her. I guarantee you not one of the men I've invited will even be remotely intimidated. Captivated? Yes. Intrigued? Yes. Ruthlessly persistent? Yes. Precisely what a Sacheron woman needs. A man who is man enough to do something about it.
Elizabeth St. Clair, nay Sacheron, nibbled her lower lip in silence.
"You know how you've been longing to see our new grandson?"
he reminded her.
"Let's just go on with our visit and see what happens. I promise you that none of the men I've chosen will harm a hair on our precious daughter's head. They might muss it up a bit, but that will be well and good for her. Our impeccable Gillian is long overdue for some mussing."
You expect me to just go off and leave her with three men? Those kind of men?
Elizabeth, those kind of men are the only kind of men who will not worship her. Besides, I was once one of those kind of men, if you recall. It will take an uncommon man for our uncommon daughter, Elizabeth.
He added more gently, I aim to find her, that uncommon man. Elizabeth sighed and blew a tendril of hair from her face.
I suppose you've the right of it,
she murmured.
She truly hasn't met a man who didn't worship her. I wonder, how do you think she'll react when she does?
I suspect she might not know what to do at first. It may throw her badly off balance, but I'm wagering one of the men I've selected will help her figure it out,
Gibraltar said smoothly. Alarm vanquished Elizabeth's despondence instantly.
That's it. We'll just have to go back. I can't be somewhere else when my daughter is experiencing these woman things for the first time. God only knows what some man will try to teach my daughter, or how he'll try to teach it to her, not to mention how shocked she's certain to be. I can't be off visiting while my daughter is being bullied and bamboozled out of her maidenhead. It simply won't do. We'll have to go home.
She gazed expectantly at her husband, awaiting his nod of agreement.
Elizabeth?
Gibraltar said her name very quietly.
Gibraltar?
Her tone was wary.
We are not turning back. We are going to visit our son, to attend our grandson's christening and spend a few months as planned.
Does Gillian know what you've done?
Elizabeth asked icily. Gibraltar shook his head.
She hasn't a suspicion in her pretty head.
What about the men? Don't you think they will tell her?
Gibraltar grinned wickedly.
I didn't tell them. I simply commanded their attendance. But Hatchard knows, and he's prepared to inform them at a suitable time.
Elizabeth was shocked.
You told no one but our chief man-at-arms.
Hatchard is a wise man. And she needs this, Elizabeth. She needs to find her own way. Besides,
he provoked,
what man would dare bamboozle a lass's maidenhead with her mother hovering at her elbow?
Ugh! My mother, my da, my seven brothers, and my grandparents being in attendance didn't stop you from bamboozling mine. Or abducting me.
Gibraltar chuckled.
Are you sorry I did?
Elizabeth gave him a steamy look from beneath her lashes that assured him to the contrary.
So, you see, sometimes a man knows best, don't you think, my dear?
She didn't reply for a moment, but Gibraltar didn't mind. He knew Elizabeth trusted him with her life. She just needed some time to get used to his plan and to accept the fact that their daughter needed a loving push over the edge of the nest. When Elizabeth finally spoke, resignation buffered her words.
Just which three men did you choose without my discerning insight and consent?
Well, there's Quinn de Moncrieff.
Gibraltar's gaze never strayed from her face. Quinn was blonde, handsome, and daring. He'd sailed black flag for the king before he'd inherited his titles, and now commanded a fleet of merchant ships, from which he'd trebled his clan's already considerable fortune. Gibraltar had fostered Quinn when he'd been a young lad, and Elizabeth had always favored him.
Good man!
A lift of a perfect golden brow betrayed grudging admiration for her husband's wisdom.
And?
Ramsay Logan.
Oh!
Elizabeth's eyes grew round.
When I saw him at court, he was clad in black from head to toe. He looked as dangerously attractive as a man could be. How is it that some woman hasn't snatched him up? Do you go on, Gibraltar? This is becoming quite promising. Who's the third?
We're lagging too far behind the guards, Elizabeth,
Gibraltar evaded glibly.
The Highlands have been peaceful lately, but we can't be too careful. We must catch up.
He shifted in his saddle, grasped her reins, and urged her to follow. Elizabeth scowled as she plucked the reins from his hand.
We'll catch them later. Who's the third?
Gibraltar frowned and gazed at the guards, who were fading out of sight around a bend.
Elizabeth, we mustn't tarry. You have no idea. The third, Gibraltar,
his wife repeated.
You look especially lovely today, Elizabeth,
Gibraltar said huskily.
Have I told you that?
When his words evoked no response but a cool, level stare, he wrinkled his brow.
"Did I say three?"
Elizabeth's expression grew cooler. Gibraltar expelled a breath of frustration. He mumbled a name and spurred his mount forward.
"What did you just say?"
she called after him, urging her mare to keep up.
"Oh, hell, Elizabeth, give over. Let's just ride. Repeat yourself, please, Gibraltar."
There was another unintelligible answer.
"I can't understand a word when you mumble,"
Elizabeth said sweetly. Sweet as siren song, he thought, and every bit as lethal.
"I said Gavra MacGilliac, all right? Leave it, will you?"
He rounded his stallion sharply and glared, savoring the fact that at least for the time being he'd rendered her as close to speechless as Elizabeth Sinclair ever came. Elizabeth stared at her husband in disbelief.
"Dear God in heaven, he summoned the berserker."
On the sloping lawn of Caithness, Gillian St. Clair shivered despite the warmth of the brightly shining sun. Not one cloud dotted the sky, and the shady forest that rimmed the south end of the lawn was a dozen yards away, not close enough to have been responsible for her sudden chill. An inexplicable sense of foreboding crept up the back of her neck. She shook it off briskly, berating her overactive imagination. Her life was as unmarred by clouds as the expansive blue sky. She was being fanciful, nothing more.
"Gillian, make Jimmy stop pulling my hair,"
Mallory cried, dashing to Gillian's side for protection. The lush green grass of the lawn was sprinkled with the dozen or so children who gathered every afternoon to cajole stories and sweets from Gillian. Sheltering Mallory in her arms, Gillian regarded the lad reprovingly.
"There are better ways to show a lass that you like her than pulling her hair, Jemmy McBean. And it's been my experience that the girls whose hair you pull now are the ones you'll be courting later." "I didn't pull her hair because I like her."
Jemmy's face turned red, and his hands curled into defiant fists.
"She's a girl." "Aye, she is. And a lovely one at that."
Gillian smoothed Mallory's luxuriant, long auburn hair. The young lass already showed promise of the beautiful woman she would become.
"Pray tell, why do you pull her hair, Jemmy?"
Gillian asked lightly. Jemmy kicked at the grass with his toes.
"Because if I punched her the same way I punched the lads, she'd probably cry,"
he mumbled.
"Why must you do anything to her at all? Why not simply talk to her?" "What could a girl have to say?"
He rolled his eyes and scowled at the other lads, wordlessly demanding support with his fierce glare. Only Zeke was unaffected by his bullying.
"Gillian has interesting things to say, Jimmy,"
Zeke argued.
"You come here every afternoon to listen to her, and she's a girl." "That's different. She's not a girl. She's almost like a mother to us, except she's a lot prettier."
Gillian brushed a strand of blonde hair back from her face with an inward wince. What had prettier ever done for her? She longed to have children of her own, but children required a husband, and one of those didn't appear to be on the horizon for her, pretty or not. Well, you could stop being so picky, her conscience advised dryly.
"Shall I tell you a story?"
She swiftly changed the subject.
"Yes, tell us a story, Gillian." "A romantic one,"
an older girl called.
"A bloody one,"
Jemmy demanded. Mallory scrunched her nose at him.
"Give us a fable. I love fables. They teach us good things, and some of us,"
she glared at Jemmy,
"need to learn good things." "Fables are dumb." "I'm not. A fable, a fable,"
the children clamored.
"A fable you shall have. I shall tell you of the argument between the wind and the sun,"
Gillian said.
"It's my favorite of all the fables."
The children jostled for the seat closest to her as they settled down to hear the tale. Zeke, the smallest of them, was shoved to the back of the cluster.
"Don't squint, Zeke,"
Gillian chided kindly.
"Here, come closer."
She drew the boy onto her lap and pushed the hair out of his eyes. Zeke was her favorite maid, Kaylee Twillow's son. He'd been born with such weak eyesight that he could scarcely see past his own hand. He was forever squinting, as if it might one day work a miracle and bring the world into focus. Gillian couldn't imagine the sorrow of not being able to clearly see the lovely landscape of Scotia, and her heart wept for Zeke's handicap. It prevented him from playing the games the other children adored. He was far more likely to be hit by the bladder-skin ball than to hit it. So to compensate, Gillian had taught him to read. He had to bury his nose in the book, but therein he'd found worlds to explore he could never have seen with his own eyes. As Zeke nestled into her lap, she began.
One day, the wind and the sun were having an argument over who was stronger, when suddenly they saw a tinker coming down the road. The sun said, "Let us decide our disputes now. Whichever of us can cause the tinker to take off his cloak shall be regarded as the stronger." The wind agreed to the contest.
"You begin,"
the sun said, and retired behind a cloud so he wouldn't interfere. The wind began to blow as hard as it could upon the tinker, but the more he blew, the tighter the tinker clutched his cloak about his body. That didn't deter the wind from giving it all he had. Still, the tinker refused to yield his cloak. Finally, the wind gave up in despair. Then the sun came out and blazed in all his glory upon the tinker, who soon found it too warm to walk with his cloak on. Removing it, he tossed the garment over his shoulder and continued on his journey, whistling cheerily.
"Yay!"
the girls cheered.
"The sun won! We like the sun better, too!"
"It's a stupid girl story,"
Jimmy scowled.
"I liked it,"
Zeke protested.
"You would, Zeke. You're too blind to be seeing warriors and dragons and swords. I like stories with adventure."
"The tale had a point, Jimmy. The same point I was making about you pulling Mallory's hair,"
Gillian said gently. Jimmy looked bewildered.
"It did. What does his son have to do with Mal's hair?"
Zeke shook his head, disgusted by Jemmy's denseness.
"She was telling us that the wind tried to make the tinker feel bad, so the tinker needed to defend himself. A son made the tinker feel good and warm and safe enough to walk freely."
Mallory beamed adoringly at Zeke, as if he were the cleverest lad in the world. Zeke continued seriously.
"So, be nice to Mallory, and she'll be nice to you."
"Where do you get your half-wit ideas?"
Jimmy asked, irritated.
"He listens, Jimmy,"
Gillian said.
"The moral of the fable is that kindness affects more than cruelty. Zeke understands that there's nothing wrong with being nice to the lasses. One day, you'll be sorry you weren't nicer."
When Zeke ends up with half the village lasses hopelessly in love with him, despite his weak vision, Gillian thought, amused. Zeke was a handsome young lad, and would one day be an attractive man possessing the unique sensitivity those born with a handicap tended to develop.
"She's right, lad."
A deep voice joined their conversation, as a man spurred his horse from the shelter of the nearby trees.
"I'm still sorry. I wasn't nicer to the lasses."
The blood in Gillian's veins chilled, and her cloudless life was suddenly awash with thick, black thunderheads. Surely, that man would never be fool enough to come back to Caithness. She pressed her cheek into Zeke's hair, hiding her face, wishing she could melt into the ground and disappear, wishing she had put on a more elegant gown this morning, as ever, wishing impossible things where this man was concerned. Although she hadn't heard his voice in years, she knew it was he.
"I recall a lass I was mean to when I was a lad, and now, knowing what I know, I'd give a great deal to take it all back."
Grim Roderick. Gillian felt as if her muscles had melted beneath her skin, fused by the heat of his voice, modulated so precisely it conveyed intimidating self-discipline. His was the voice of a man in control. She raised her head and stared at him, her eyes wide with shock and horror. Her breath caught in her throat. No matter how the years changed him, she would always recognize him. He'd dismounted and was approaching her, moving with the detached arrogance and grace of a conqueror, exuding confidence as liberally as he exhaled. Grim Roderick had always been a walking weapon, his body developed and honed to instinctual perfection. Were she to scramble to her feet and faint left, Gillian knew he'd be there before her. Were she to back up, he'd be behind her. Were she to scream, he could cover her mouth before she'd even finished drawing her breath in preparation. She'd only once before seen a creature move with such speed and repressed power. One of the mountain cats, whose muscles bunched in springy recoil as they padded about on dangerous paws. She drew a shaky breath. He was even more magnificent than he'd been years ago. His black hair was neatly restrained in a leather thong. The angle of his jaw was even more arrogant than she remembered, if that was possible. Jutting slightly forward, it caused his lower lip to curl in a sensual smirk, regardless of the occasion. The air itself felt different when Grim Roderick was in it. Her surroundings receded until nothing existed but him. And she could never mistake those eyes. Mocking blue ice, his gaze locked with hers over the heads of the forgotten, curious children. He was watching her with an unfathomable expression. She lunged to her feet, tumbling a startled Zeke to the ground. As Gillian stared wordlessly at Grim, memories surfaced, and she nearly drowned in the bitter bile of humiliation. She recalled too clearly the day she'd vowed never to speak to Grim Roderick again. She'd sworn never to permit him near Caithness, or near her vulnerable heart again, as long as she lived. And he dared saunter up now, as if nothing had changed? The possibility of reconciliation was instantly squashed beneath the weighty heels of her pride. She would not dignify his presence with words. She would not be nice. She would not grant him 1 ounce of courtesy. Grim worried a hand through his hair and took a deep breath.
"You've grown, lass."
Gillian struggled to speak. When she finally found her tongue, her words dripped ice.
"How dare you come back here? You are not welcome. Leave my home."
"I can't do that, Gillian."
His soft voice unnerved her. Her heart racing, she drew a slow, deep breath.
"If you don't leave, of your own accord, I'll summon the guards to remove you."
"They won't do that, Gillian."
She clapped her hands.
"Guards!"
she cried. Grim didn't move an inch.
"It won't help, Gillian."
"And quit saying my name like that."
"Like what, Gillian?"
He sounded genuinely curious.
Like a prayer or something?"
"As you wish."
He paused the length of 2 heartbeats, during which she was astonished he'd capitulated to her will, because he certainly never had before. Then he added with such husky resonance that it slipped inside her heart without her consent,
"Gillian, perish the man."
"Guards! Guards!"
Her guards arrived on a run, then halted abruptly, studying the man standing before their mistress.
"Milady, you summoned?"
Hatchard inquired.
"Remove this iniquitous scoundrel from Caithness before he brings,
she corrected herself hastily,
"his depravity and wicked insolence into my home."
She sputtered to a finish. The guards looked from her to Grim and didn't move.
"Now, remove him from the estate at once."
When the guards still didn't move, her temper rose a notch.
"Hatchard, I said make him leave. By the sweet saints, toss him out of my life! Banish him from the country! Och, just remove him from this world, will you now?"
The flank of guards stared at Gillian with open-mouthed astonishment.
"Are you feeling well, milady?"
Hatchard asked.
"Should we fetch Cayley to see if you've a touch of the fever?"
"I don't have a touch of anything. There's a degenerate knave on my estate, and I want him off it!"
Gillian said through gritted teeth.
"Did you just grit?"
Hatchard gaped.
"Pardon?"
"Grit. It means to speak from between clenched teeth."
"I am going to scream from between clenched teeth if you disobedient wretches don't remove this degenerate, virile—"
Gillian cleared her throat.
"Vile rogue from Caithness."
"Scream?"
Hatchard repeated faintly.
"Gillian St. Clair doesn't scream. She doesn't grit, and she certainly doesn't have fits of temper.
What the devil is going on here?
He's the devil,
Gillian seethed, motioning to Grimm.
Call him what you will, my lady. I still can't remove him,
Hatchard said heavily. Gillian's head jerked as if he'd struck her.
You disobey me?
He doesn't disobey you, Gillian, Grimm said quietly. He obeys your da.
What?
She turned her ashen face to his. He proffered a crumpled, soiled piece of parchment.
What is that?
She asked icily, refusing to move even an inch closer.
Come and see, Gillian,
he offered. His eyes glittered strangely.
Hatchard, get that from him.
Hatchard didn't budge.
I know what it says.
Well, then what does it say?
She snapped at Hatchard.
And how do you know?
It was Grimm who answered.
It says, come for Gillian. Gillian.
He'd done it again, added her name after a pause, a husky veneration that left her oddly breathless and frightened. There was a warning in the way he was saying her name, something she should understand, but couldn't quite grasp. Something had changed since they'd last fought so bitterly, something in him, but she couldn't define it.
Come for Gillian,
she repeated blankly.
My da sent you that?
When he nodded, Gillian choked and nearly burst into tears. Such a public display of emotion would have been a first for her. Instead, she did something as unexpected and heretofore undone as gritting and cursing. Gillian spun on her heel and bolted toward the castle as if all the banshees of Scotland were nipping at her heels, when in truth it was the one and only Grimm Roderick, which was far worse. Sneaking a glance over her shoulder, she belatedly remembered the children. They were standing in a half-circle, gaping at her with disbelief. She stormed, absolutely mortified, into the castle. Slamming the door was a bit difficult, since it was four times as tall as she was. But in her current temper, she managed. Chapter 3
Inconceivable!
Gillian seethed as she paced her chambers. She tried to calm down, but reluctantly concluded that until she got